pull the door shut a little bit.
Oh, sure. Interrupted, but...
Tony has... She's not there?
Yeah.
Tony has the key.
All right. So, it is Thursday, November 11th, and we're here at Christ Community Church with Pastor Jeff Barkley. And Jeff, just one more time for on the record, we want to make sure that you have consent to have this interview posted online. Is
sure.
that correct?
Okay. Absolutely. Great. I'm happy to do it.
Well, then, let's go ahead, and why don't we get a little bit of your background and where you came from, what your upbringing was like, okay. just to get to know you a little more.
Raised in Central Illinois, raised United Methodist, very active in local church, married a girl from that little Methodist church in McLean, Illinois, on Old Route 66. Early on as a college student, I was our lay leader for our United Methodist Church. Became a Christian in college at Illinois Wesleyan University my sophomore year. Really felt called to ministry almost immediately, though I've done lots of other things along the way. Departed from the faith a little bit my senior year, so I was considering law. I had been working as a professional scuba diver in the summers, and so I didn't go into ministry immediately. I was also an athlete, so I decided to coach and teach. Was working towards my master's in sports administration, exercise physiology, was our head women's track coach at Illinois Wesleyan University. Lacked all but my thesis for my sports administration degree, and chose not to go into professional scuba diving, though there was a lot of money in that. Began to teach public school, taught creationism in my science classrooms in 1980-81. Was not going to be tenured in 83 or 82, so I quit, and being an out-of-work teacher, began a church with several other men, an independent church separate from the United Methodist Church. And since this is a history, you know, a project on religion, really did that because in our view, the United Methodist Church, no offense to those folks, we believe they were departing a bit from the moorings and the original anchor of the United Methodist Church. I'm still a fan of John Wesley. I think if the Methodists would have hung tighter with Wesley, Methodists would probably still be a Methodist. And I don't mean that to sound offensive, but you want honesty in the interview. And so it was an independent church, and a successful church after about the seventh year. It became an extremely successful church. Numerically, we were growing very fast. And in the tenth year, one of the co-founding pastors, my mentor, my Greek teacher and my mentor, began to have marital problems, and the church split three ways. I kept a third, another pastor left, he kept a third, and another third fell through the cracks, which happens often in church splits. Ron had been my mentor, I became his counselor, and it didn't work. I was 10 years his junior. And so being 30 years old and now ready to learn. Up to that point, I was going to do church the way Jesus wanted it to be done. And unknown to me, everyone else has been trying to do that for centuries. I thought I was the first one who really wanted to do it the way Jesus wanted it done. And so naively, I went into ministry with that mindset. When I was 30 years old, I realized how little I knew, how desperate I was for another mentor. And there had been a gentleman in Bloomington, Norma, Illinois, Reverend Norman Jones, who was a Church of God pastor, Cleveland, Tennessee, a classical Pentecostal denomination that I admired greatly. Our vision for our local church that had begun, Living Word Fellowship, followed the Methodist model of planting congregations in all the farm towns. And so we had gone around on Wednesdays, pass out tracts, visit homes, and then have basically an old-fashioned tent meeting on Saturdays in city squares in Central Illinois, in lots of communities in McLean County and that immediate area of McLean County, surrounding villages in McLean County. And but what he had done, every time his church became 150, 200 people, he split it off because he was bringing people in from the farm towns around Bloomington Normal. And I loved that model, and that was our model. So I merged my remaining congregation in with his. It had been meeting in a funeral home, and there was Ichabod written all over that group and the funeral home. And so I spent a very, very powerful year with Norman Jones, and decided to join the Church of God, Cleveland, Tennessee, though I was never, could never classify myself as a classical Pentecostal. I admired him as my mentor. And being new in that movement and not having a daddy who was also a pastor, I had to start at the bottom of the totem pole. And there was a church in Galesburg, Illinois that was always open. They had begun in 1958, and frankly had exchanged pastors about once a year, and it was always available. It was the church that many people used if they wanted a pastor in Illinois. They would take Galesburg, Illinois, and then find another church eventually. So I went as a it was a restart. The church building was empty at the time when I got there, and had 3 months to get it back on budget or we wouldn't stay. And God was very merciful, and within 3 months we were on budget, and they were able to support me, and we were there 15 years in Galesburg, Illinois. In the course of that time, we bought a bigger building, remodeled a bigger building. I became administrative bishop over for Western Illinois, helped start a Christian school in Galesburg, Illinois. I've been white my entire life, but got very active in racial interracial ministry, became president of the Black Ministerial Alliance of Western Illinois, which is kind of funny for a freckle-faced Scottish guy. In the course of that time, I got a master's in theology, focusing on Old Testament studies. The resolution of conflict in the Pentateuch was my master's thesis. And then a doctor of ministry while I was in Galesburg as well. Taught in the Christian school, taught worldview. Since I have a background in science, I also taught physics and chemistry in that Christian school. I was a busy guy. My wife and I have 7 children, and somehow we managed to do all of those things. And about 1993, I was feeling a release from Galesburg, Illinois, but I wasn't feeling led to just take another church in the movement. Mm-hmm. My doctor of ministry made me think I wanted to teach somewhere. Since it's not a PhD, my doctor of ministry is a study of everyone else's PhDs.
Yeah.
I couldn't find the exact place where I really wanted to live, and we had gone through administrators nearly every year for our Christian school. I thought, well, maybe that would be a good step for me professionally. And through a series of events, I ended up in Lawrence, Kansas to be the administrator of Veritas Christian School, a classical Christian school, K-12 school here in town. And was there from 2004 until March of 2009. And my resignation there was amiable. In fact, I still do consulting with private Christian schools. I spoke at a large conference just last week for the ACSI convention, Teachers Educators Convention for the South Central Region. I spoke at classical Christian school conventions as well, and I'm actually the director for school choice for Kansas, a group called PIC, Parents in Control. And but I was missing the ebb and flow of pastoral ministry. I was missing the opportunity to teach more regularly before a congregation, though I did lots of speaking before churches at Veritas Christian School. Was actually interim pastor for a church in Topeka for a while I was doing that, and an interim pastor for a church in Wamego, Kansas as well. But that brought me to Christ Community Church. I was in the process of moving my ordination to another movement, to another denomination, and I discovered the Evangelical Free Churches of America with strong Scandinavian roots. And their doctrinal statement really reflected mine much more than the doctrinal statement of the Church of God Cleveland, Tennessee ever did, even though I, you know, was an administrative bishop for that movement and well-respected, served on numbers of state boards and spoke at Church of God events and camp meetings. I was never what one would refer to as a classical Pentecostal, which by definition would be that, you know, speaking in tongues is the sign of the filling of the Holy Spirit, that there's a second work of grace known as sanctification. I'm a progressive sanctification person, not an instantaneous one. I believe we're sanctified when we come to Christ, and then there's an ongoing process of sanctification through discipleship, not a moment in time where I become sanctified and no more do I sin. Though the Church of God would believe that on paper. It's not practiced, that's what they would say on paper, and I never really embraced that. And I've never been to Cleveland, Tennessee, by the way, either. EFCA movement was one I was going to go into anyway, and I'd been the guest speaker here at Christ Community Church off and on for several years. Had felt a real affinity to this congregation, and when a position opened, I was urged by the elders to apply, and it was best for them if I started in the spring, which was difficult for Veritas, but I remained as their administrative consultant through the remainder of that year, and actually last year did much of that as well. And again, I'm still speaking and consulting privately with other Christian schools. Mm-hmm. That brings us to today.
Yeah, absolutely. So then if that gives us a little glimpse about how you got here, then what can you shed light in terms of Christ Community Church's background itself? Do you know anything about its early days?
Well, in 1988, it began under the leadership of Bo Abernathy. It was a plant from a very large Christ Community Church in Leawood, Kansas, also members of the Evangelical Free Church of America. And in those days, they met where the Quail Creek apartments are. And lots of folks in town are familiar with that little clubhouse. It's a very small clubhouse. I've had relatives live there, and I've swam in the pool and been in the clubhouse, and it's small. Then from there, they moved to at that time was a Baptist church in the corner of 5th and Castle, 15th Street and Castle, mm-hmm. just down the street from here. And I'm forgetting the name of that congregation now. I know the pastor there very well, but I'm forgetting the name, but can't remember the name. Anyway, at that time it was a small Baptist church, and they shared that facility. Christ Community Church did their services in the morning there, and then the older, smaller Baptist church met during their regular time at night. And then in about 1995, that church actually disbanded because there were so many major repairs that needed to be done on that property there, 15th and Castle. Also known as Bob Billings Parkway, but Christ Community Church bought that building, did lots of remodeling, lots of heating and air conditioning improvements, put a new roof on, took out the pews, put in chairs for flexibility, the playground equipment that's still there they built and put in. Then they actually began to rent. They were having three services a Sunday in that little building. They began to rent some space in the strip mall right across the street, right down Castle. And about that time, and this was about 1997, and the church began about that same time, there was only about room for 120 in that building. They had the three services. This property came for sale. The Archdiocese of Kansas City purchased a lot of property west of town, and that's where they moved their church. And so this became available, and so Christ Community Church raised the monies, bought this property, and then with a special gift really from just one individual, well, they were able to buy the wooded part south of this property as well. So we own this whole block. That was probably 1998 is when that happened. And so that property that was purchased by a single individual is really used as the collateral to finish the purchase of this property. And so they've been here since the late 90s, and Bo Abernathy stayed for 10 years. An associate by the name of Bill Herbert followed Bo and served here for, I have to be careful with the math here, 6 or 7 years, but 5 of those were as an associate. And then he was here for 2 years and felt like he really wasn't the one to take the church to, quote unquote, the next level by his own admission. The church probably had an attendance of about 600 at its high point. Again, had double services here. Plans exist to build the actual sanctuary in front of this current facility. In fact, they just happen to be right here in my office, not because of you were coming in. We've been looking at those. This was to be the multipurpose building originally. And whether that's the building we would ever build in front, we're not sure. Bo left, followed then by Bill's leadership. When Bill stepped down, the church really remained without a senior pastor for over a year. Bo Abernathy, the founding pastor's son, had some real severe illness. And what happened, they couldn't get insurance coverage, and they discovered the Southern Baptist Convention had excellent insurance through Blue Cross Blue Shield. So the church took on a co-membership of the Southern Baptist Convention as well as the Evangelical Free Churches of America, which is actually who founded the church. And so the new staff that was being hired on along the way, they hired a full-time youth pastor. Along the way, they hired a full-time associate pastor to manage discipleship in small groups. This church is still strongly anchored in a small group ministry. Sunday morning service, midweek services really have never been a focal point of this church, but then small group meetings throughout the week, which is typical of a lot of successful churches in this day and age, as opposed to what I came from in the Church of God. Was you had church Sunday morning, you had church Sunday night, and you had church Wednesday, and if you were faithful, you attended all three. When I think of the 15 years I was there preaching three times a week, that's a lot of sermons that people heard me preach. And then children's pastor was also hired. So at one time, this church had a pastoral staff of four. Then they hired a full-time music director who also took on technology role. So he was full-time, and then a full-time administrative assistant. So there was a time where this church had a full-time staff of six. And when Bill left, they spent a long time looking and were interviewing both Southern Baptists as well as Evangelical Free Church pastors. It boiled down between a Southern Baptist pastor and an Evangelical Free pastor. The Southern Baptist candidate decided that the building was inadequate for what he was looking for in a new position, so he withdrew his name, and another individual. I don't know if names are important, if that matters, but does that matter in an interview? Probably.
No, if you feel comfortable dropping names in, by all means do so.
Yeah. John Allen was that person. He came here from California. And was hired then to be the a senior pastor. The church had leadership concerns. Frankly, the congregation becomes somewhat siloed in their ministries. The associate pastor doing the small group leadership and discipleship did his thing. The youth pastor, frankly, did his thing. And the senior pastor tried to do his thing. And the children's ministry pastor, she did her thing. And it was a siloed ministry, very compartmentalized, very isolated from one another. And the congregation at that time had the money to continue just to hire people to do things that the vision now is that the body itself should be doing some of this ministry. No, nothing wrong with hiring professional staff and paid staff and delegated responsibilities. So in the course of that, when Bill left, the church is empty. They hired John. The associate pastor, Mark Day, decided to go on the mission field. So he's now in Argentina and being and very successful. Mark Knight was asked to leave, and he did. Jill, I'm good friends with Jill to this day. His mother was very ill in Indiana, so she moved away. But during the course of that time, the attendance had been dropping, and so the income had been dropping. And so from a high point of maybe 600, they probably had dropped about 350, would be an estimate, in attendance with two services. And through the course of that, then I was hired after John Allen was hired. So when I was hired, John Allen at that time was the only staff member, and I was officially hired to be the growth and discipleship pastor because of my education background. About a year after Pastor Allen came, it was realized that it wasn't a good fit. This church is intentionally wanting to be relevant without changing the gospel, to contextualize the gospel without compromising it. I think that's a common thread now in many churches that want to be evangelical, but realizing the culture's changing and the ready voice that we used to have in the culture, you know, the evangelical voice became politicized, you know, a few years ago through the moral majority. Yeah. I mean, I'm a proponent of those views, but we pushed ourselves off into the corner unwittingly and unknowingly at the time. I was very politically active in Illinois, and I frankly felt used by politicians, principally sometimes the Republican Party, because morally I'm pro-life. I can't help but be pro-life, and on paper, Republicans are pro-life, and I was going to vote that and believe that economics would take care of the rest. So I tended not to vote with economic goals, but honoring the unborn. And evangelicalism became politicized, and we're better. Frankly, I think the Bible is better than politics and usurps all of those things. And so our challenge here as a church is to be biblically conservative, but not frighten off those that we believe we are called to convert. So that's the challenge. And John, it's humorous but sad. Everybody in California is cool and hip, right? I mean, that's the persona here in the Midwest. We're all backwards, and if you live on the coast, you're forward thinking. And I really think that there was a belief that someone from California, in Lawrence, Kansas, being somewhat known as a liberal community, could help us learn how to do that. It didn't work. It just wasn't working well. So Pastor John was asked to leave. At that time, I stepped in and have been leading since. I've just recently gone through the search process. I was the only candidate, but I've gone through the search process now to be officially hired as the lead pastor. They're moving away from the senior pastor title to a lead pastor. It may only be a change in name, but it does kind of reorientate the congregation as to what the role of that head person would be. The way we're governed, we're autonomous. We're congregationally led, and then elders are delegated with responsibilities. And right now I'm a paid elder, which is really orientation the congregation has always had. But not every pastor was an elder, and that did create a group of elders and pastors, congregation. And it wasn't a healthy, frankly, it wasn't a healthy environment. So we have since introduced a twice annual evaluation procedure of all ministries, including the elders. There, up to that point, there really had not been a good system of evaluation. Coming from my background in education, evaluation is invaluable. Identifying the wins and then asking folks, hey, how are we doing? And so I regularly solicit, I'm an intelligent guy, but I regularly solicit the input from the PhDs in our congregation, as well as the laborer, and to ask, did I communicate well? Is the plate that I'm serving this meal on at least recognizable? Hopefully the information is new and fresh and lively, but the goal would be that the plate I put it on is somewhat recognizable. And we are seriously working now towards, we believe that service is the best apologetic that we can come up with for the gospel by serving the community. So we're using the phrase externally focused, internally strong is really our mantra. On paper, you'll see the phrase building relationships, growing in Christ. It pretty much says the same thing. We've another word picture we've used is window seats versus an aisle seat in an aircraft, and we borrowed that from a book that we've read. But if you fly regularly, those people take the aisle seat, they get in their aisle seat, they don't talk to anybody, and when the plane lands, they jump off the plane, and we're urging people to not get in and get off as fast as a lot of people do, to not be a consumer of the church, but to be an active participant. It's not that unusual. I mean, every church is striving to do that, obviously, but coming up with some word pictures seem to be helping us. So we're asking everyone to have an aisle seat and a window seat in the congregation. And to regain the trust in this community of the evangelical church by serving and making the first step, which is, I think, really a model of Jesus, who never compromised his message ever, but his example on the cross was to be, he died for us. And if that's the hallmark of Christian ministry, to do something on behalf of another, that may be sometimes where the evangelical has missed it. We know truth. We believe we know the truth, and we readily will share that. But have we put it in a body, in human form, which is what Jesus did? So that's our goal. History will tell us if we are doing that successfully. The church did drop to about, maybe 156 in attendance just as I was coming in. And now we're averaging a little over 200, maybe 200 adults and 40 children is probably what we're having now. Financially, we're close to the budget that we had prescribed, and we're just now tonight meeting and deciding about hiring a very qualified youth pastor. In this process, we'd considered hiring a novice that I could mentor and train, but the church is recovering and growing, and we're adding people every week, and I just don't think I have the time to mentor. So we decided to, in the course of interviews, we thought, let's go big, think big, and a candidate that has built two very large youth groups has become available, and I think he's captured our vision, and the facility is inadequate, really, for what our vision is, not wanting to sound naive, but our God is a big God, and we feel like I was just typing when you came in. We're at the Red Sea, and it's time for we as the elders to hold the staff up and watch God part the sea. And that's going to be the challenge of the congregation.
Ideally, what does that vision look like in this parting of the seas? What does this expansion or...
If you can hear the heart in this phrase, then we want to become the best church. And again, we're modeling this and copying this a little bit from things that we've read, but we've read a lot of things. And in a sentence, we want to become the best church for Lawrence as opposed to the best church in Lawrence. And just changing that preposition, we think, changes a lot of things. The best church in Lawrence obviously sounds somewhat egocentric. And misunderstood, the best church for Lawrence could too, but we're aware that if we're going to do that, the four part infers serving, the four part infers inconveniencing ourselves on behalf of others, which none of that is the norm of our culture right now. We're fairly self-centered as a culture, church or unchurched or churched. We don't necessarily think that the non-churched are any more serving than... There's a lot of symbolism over substance with the church and the non-churched, and we're wanting to put legs to that. Service preaches easy. I mean, I can preach that, but doing it means sweat and blood and financial cost, and it maybe means watching a little less TV. It might mean not just having brunch on Saturday morning. It might mean raking someone's leaves or hammering a nail or two or picking up trash. So that's where we're at right now. That's really the focus now. All summer long for life training, we had community leaders come and speak to us everywhere from the homeless shelter to we have folks that do serve at Link and other places, but Teen Challenge, prison ministry, the representatives from the Leo Center, and Dr. Sale, who has left Leo Center, now starting his own clinic, New Hope, with... New Hope Fellowship, formerly Heartland Church downtown. Mm-hmm. So we had Dr. Sale come in. I'm good friends with Dr. Sale. He taught biology when I was at Veritas. Still does. Never charges us, and he's an outstanding man. Anyway, so we had lots of community people to introduce our church to those folks, introduce those folks to us. Our final speaker was Mike Amos, Mayor Amix, and spoke very articulately about the place the church can fill in a community. I mean, communities are driven by volunteerism. He pointed out how many commissions in the city remain open. No one takes those spots. And, just recently we hosted a Dave Ramsey simulcast, mm-hmm. and the theme of that was entrepreneur leadership. And we see that's a real opportunity for us as a church to take a leadership role in our society. Entrepreneurship with ideas and service. And so adopting that orientation, the timing of Ramsey's simulcast was very perfect for us.
Okay, so then going back to this idea of service and introducing people in the congregation to other organizations that are around here, would you say that rather than trying to bring up your own specific programs, you're just trying to find ways to strengthen and bolster what else is around and kind of have a more collaborative
effort. To partner with the community. Mm-hmm. It's going to bring an element of trust. Let's face it, you know, we here believe that there are absolute truths. And yet, in a culture that tends not to embrace that notion, we feel like working side by side with someone will give us that ability. Here's what I'm going to tell the congregation Sunday. Every relationship has to be strong enough to bear the weight of truth. If that phrase makes sense, maybe you've heard that phrase before, but you know, the relationships we want to establish in the community need to be strong enough so that when we share what we believe to be truth, that relationship is strong enough to handle it. And that's a challenge for us. You don't do that overnight. It requires some heavy lifting independent before you... People don't touch each other in the first place. I mean, we hardly ever hold each other anymore, right? And so the holding we're talking about is an emotional holding to be there. The ministry of presence is another phrase that I often use. Bring credibility and put some substance to what we claim to be. It's a challenge, you know. To the degree that we do it well, I think that will be the degree that we actually do get to become the best church for Lawrence. And by the way, I wouldn't bother me if every church told you the exact same thing. I've been involved in marketing. I worked for General Telephone. I worked for a newspaper when I was church planting, and I would point out, you know, the reason a McDonald's and a Hardee's and a Burger King and a Dairy Queen are on the same corners is the success of one brings success to others. And I'm president of the Ministerial Association for Lawrence, and so for the Lawrence Association of Evangelicals, and I'm absolutely convinced that one church isn't going to accomplish the mission of Christ in this city, and the success of one church can open the door for success for others. They know that in the business world. That's why there's strip malls. Sometimes in that strip mall, there's two companies selling the exact same products, but there's a reason why they're sharing space. And that lights me up. You know, I'm having been involved in a lot of interracial ministry. I don't even like talking about color, but it's there. Having been the president of the Black Ministerial Alliance of Western Illinois, which included from Rock Island, Davenport, Illinois, clear down to Quincy, Illinois, over to Peoria, and back up to Galesburg, a large area. So I've always been, since I moved here, I've been a part of the Martin Luther King Day Steering Committee. I'm very good friends with Paul Wynn, who would be a good guy for you to meet if you ever met Paul. Paul used to work for the city. He was an investigator for human rights violations, that kind of thing for the city. Reverend Paul Wynn, his church is just off downtown. It's the Church of Christ. I'm drawing a blank. Praise Temple, Church of Christ. Paul would definitely got to talk to Paul. Okay. Best dressed man in town. You tell him that.
Okay.
He is. But he's the president of the Ecumenical Fellowship, which is predominantly the Black Ministerial Association. And to be honest, in Free State Lawrence, Kansas, it seems a little weird, wrong, that there is a predominantly black Ministerial Association and a predominantly white. Though African-American pastors are members of LAE, and I regularly, you know, attend ecumenical fellowship things. And so in May, through perhaps the unifying group, the Greater Lawrence Christian Men's Fellowship, which is a non-denominational group headed by Mark Griffin, I'm on the steering committee of that organization, Turner Gill, the head football coach who is African-American, is going to be speaking at a breakfast in May, and we're hoping that representatives of LAE and the Ecumenical Fellowship can attend that breakfast and you know, maybe become eventually one. My goal, frankly, I'm not sure how much longer I'll be president of the Ministerial Association, would be, while there may remain autonomous groups just for some reason, that there would be a very, very close working relationship between these two fellowships. It just seems silly that there are two. Because this is an evangelical, both of our groups are evangelical orientated ministerial alliances, and it seems to only make sense that the two would be working more closely together. We're clearly aligned in mission, so why not work together?
Yeah. Well, still kind of hovering around this Lawrence context in addressing this goal to be the best church for Lawrence, what are some of the challenges that are specific to Lawrence? And a lot of people will say, being in Kansas, Lawrence is kind of an anomaly. It's a different place than the rest of Kansas. So
somewhat.
What kind of challenges does that present? Or do you see it as being challenging, or do you see it
well,
as
being... Well, you know, I said it like this. If I'm a life insurance salesman and I discover that I'm moving to a community that a lot of people don't have life insurance, that's where I want to open my shop. When I came, I saw a study, and I don't have it in front of me. You can probably find it, that said that Lawrence, Kansas is the sixth least. Have you come across this in any of your interviews?
Not yet.
That Lawrence, Kansas is the sixth least church city of 100,000 or more in the United States of America. That's what I was told. David Taylor, who was Paul Taylor's son, was the one who showed me the study first. Paul Taylor is the associate pastor at Mustard Seed.
Yeah.
And I know that study is available. I've seen it. And the study also went so far as to count available pew space in this town. And you'd have to check the article to... I'm not even sure who did the study, but I saw charts and numbers that only 40% of the population could fit in our churches if every pew was full. So this is really an underchurched. I don't know if it's unchurched. It's an underchurched community. I came from Galesburg, Illinois, where there were three times more churches in a town of 36,000 than there is in this town. In this town, because there is I don't know that liberal is the right word. I'm not sure what the word you use. Unchurched, a resistance towards absolutes. The storefront churches don't really exist in this town as much as in some communities. Either church makes it or does not. If the average church in America is under 100, we don't have a lot of those churches. We may have attendances, you know, hovering just below that, but on paper they're much larger, and neither church in this town looks like it either makes it or it doesn't. And that may be where that statistic comes, being the sixth least church town. Because there aren't a lot of storefront signs where you got 25 people attending a church, and in Galesburg, Illinois, we had a lot of that. But that's what makes up the body of believers in the United States of America. I mean, there's the mega churches, but... Frankly, we forget about the broader base, which is much, much smaller churches all over. You know, go to Western Kansas, you know, and they're vibrant ministries, but in very small communities. Thereby, then the churches tend to be small.
Yeah.
So for us, I mean, in this environment, we just can't afford to apologize for what we believe, and so our goal here is Walmart does everything they can, whether you probably in this town, a lot of people don't even like Walmart, but, you know, their goal is to remove every barrier to a customer. You know, they want to be an attractive place when people come in. They want to be a friendly place. That's why they have greeters. They want to be full service if they possibly can. And that's a challenge, I think, for churches. We have to take an honest look at ourselves and ask ourselves, are there barriers to communicating what we believe to be true? Let's face it, Christianity has its own distinct language, its own distinct terms, and we have to make sure that that the words we're using are understood by our listeners. That forces us to go back and check the words we're using. You know, all of my messages are on a keynote or a PowerPoint. The scriptures tend to be on the screen in case someone didn't bring a Bible, but I also put the page numbers. We have two versions of it. Pew Bibles, and so on my screen when I'm reading a text, it references where to look in those Bibles to find that specific passage in case someone can't find the book of the Bible. And why would we expect them to know it if they're unchurched? And so we've tried to remove that barrier. If a cup of coffee means anything to someone, you know, you can take coffee in the sanctuary. We cross that bridge by just saying, hey, you got to have a lid on it. And periodically, our janitors are cleaning up coffee spills. But to think of ourselves as that first time visitor. And so we're asking ourselves the hard questions, and it's not any fun because no one thinks they're unfriendly. No one even wants to admit that they're not conveying the message. My test, really, frankly, has been University of Kansas professors, full PhDs, who worship here, who believe what we believe, as in absolute truth, and a university that, frankly, doesn't portray that as believe, all views are equal. And they figure out how to survive in that environment and be very successful in their careers. And so I use them kind of right now. That's what I'm weighing my messages against. How did I do compared to how you've survived in the university setting? And so far I'm getting good marks. And there are times when I've had to go back and rethink what I've said. It's usually the fact that I talk too fast as opposed to that something I said wasn't understandable. But, if you talk fast, people listen better. Throw in a lot of humor in the messages. So the challenge is putting what we believe in that are absolutes in terms that are recognizable and understandable by the greater community. And that's going to be an ongoing process because culture changes quick, but for instance, we have a very active web page. I think every church probably does now. We have Facebook pages for our youth group. We have a Facebook page for our church. When I first came here, I had lived on email with the adults at Veritas Christian School. I was working a lot with high school and college students at the time. They never responded to emails, but if I would text them at 3 a.m., it was like Jesus just spoke because I got a text, and I can always get them to respond with a text. I'm getting those as we're sitting here from people, assuming that I'm going to respond like they would. And so, with younger folks, college students, we can print the bulletin announcement. We can make it a verbal announcement before service. And then they will call me and they'll ask me what's going on. I said, well, we announced it. It's in the bulletin. And then they will say, but I couldn't find anything about it on the website. And since it wasn't on the website, it still isn't quite true yet. It's just a new way of communicating, and whether we like it or not, that's reality. And we're coming out of the Church of God. Church of God is still growing overseas, but in the United States, it's dwindling because they're not changing their styles. They're just not. And that's a shame. And you could talk to... I just talked to a young man here whose father's a pastor in Texas. He says, I go back and nothing has changed since I was a teenager, and now a church that was once 500 is about 75. And I think that's a shame. And for me being 54 years old, that's my challenge too, because there's a lot of old school stuff in me, and the goal is to keep the old school and grow and change.
Okay, well, shifting gears just a little bit. So say I show up on Sunday for a service. What can I expect? What is it going to be like?
Our worship is going to be contemporary, but it's going to, and if we're going to, it's going to be contemporary. We don't use a choir. We have a praise team. Mm-hmm. Just about everybody's doing that now these days. We're going to sing some songs that if you listen to contemporary Christian radio, we're going to sing those songs. But we have found a very good balance of old and new. We'll sing Amazing Grace here in the holidays in particular. We're going to sing some of the old hymns. They may have a little bit of a fresh sound, but they're going to be recognizable. Well, I'm 54. We have folks in the late 80s. This church actually is pretty. It's a very rich congregation demographically. We have the full gamut. We're not just a young congregation. We have old folks that have embraced this view, which I'm guessing in this community there are churches that have a lot more internal tension because of what we're trying to do here. That generation older than me is embracing this. We're just not having to have those kinds of discussions. Why? And if we do, we satisfy those questions with our responses. So if you come in, you're going to see worship that is not over the top edgy. By some standards, it probably would be edgy, but for me, it really isn't over the top edgy. In fact, probably my personal taste would be louder, bolder than even what we have. Words are going to be flashed up on the screen. We don't use hymnals anymore. If we sing a hymn, the words are up on the screen. We're going to use humor, drama for our announcements. We're going to use humor and drama for our sermons. I will habitually, in my keynote PowerPoint, we use Max around here, so it's keynote. You're going to see a video clip in a lot of my messages. There's going to be a welcoming time where people get to interact for a few moments and shake one another's hands. We challenge the regulars to move from their little circle.
Okay.
Some do that extremely well. Some do not. At the close of our service, we tend not to give a dramatic invitation. There will be those occasions where we might. Our communion is open. We leave that to... we take communion first Sunday of the month. Anyone that... whose conscience allows them, and we really leave that to them to decide. We'll allow small children to take communion with their families if their parents want to do that. Sometimes it's because they are in the faith, so to speak, they've made a confession of faith, or taking a covenantal view from Passover, which is where communion came from, the whole family took it, young and old alike, and that's my orientation. And the Evangelical Free Church is specific in some areas, but not so specific to be divisive in evangelical areas. I mean, it's an evangelical statement of faith, but not so specific to become overly divisive. Any evangelical would agree with our doctrine of faith, and our goal is, while our service is really geared towards the believer, it is a believer service, it's not a seeker service, really. In my teaching style, I try to have three shelves, to be totally honest. Something at the lower shelf, the middle for everyone, and then that more discerning student of the Word. And I don't do that to throw a bone out there. I do it intentionally. But, you know, if there's a nuance of a Greek phrase that some of those students of the Word would know and understand there's an issue there, I'm very smoothly I can put that in, whether it's having studied Hebrew and Greek both. I mean, I can do that if I need to. Again, it's not to show what I am or what I'm not. It's with an intentionality. But we do orientate more towards a believer's service, but we would be really silly to purposely pretend like we're not going to grow without visitors. And, we thought maybe we would grow more through small groups, inviting people to come to their small group and then bringing them to the larger, assimilate them that way. Let's face it, if you've got a small group of 12 people that are meeting in a home for a couple of months and you bring in a new family, that may be a tougher assimilation than someone coming into a worship service that has 200 people in it. So we let the visitors stay autonomous somewhat, but you're going to get we're reorientating our gift bag, which will have information in it, the necessary ink pen, I think our gift bag is going to be including a red box, free movie, a bucket of popcorn to pop, and Skittles for the kids. And that's what we're going at right now. If you came this Sunday, you wouldn't get that, but that's the plan. We have just we're organizing a marketing committee that is going to help us really think through all of that. And really intentionally think it through. That anything that we're doing, we know why we're doing it, and it's intentional. And if we can't really defend why we're doing it, we're trying not to do it. We really are. So we don't use the word program around here. We use the word process or steps. You know, steps are things that you get to leave behind to go higher. Programs, for heaven's sakes, take on a life of their own. You can't kill a program. You just can't. I mean, to kill a program is to kill a human being sometimes. You know, you can't do that. So we're changing terminology, and it's been positive. Processes and steps. Whatever. If we do have a program, it's with an end in sight, and when we reach that end, and the program stop, so it's a process or a step. You can change steps, you can change processes, but you can't change programs. You know, I would not, frankly, when I was visiting speaker, I would have not have said that we were a friendly church, even as a guest. I really wouldn't have. And yet people tell us that we are a friendly church. So either something has changed in the last year and a half. I don't think it's just me. I think the orientation of the church, when numbers began to dwindle, they were taking a lot of things for granted, I think, at that point. And this church was a very much of a come and see. And if you came, you could leave with no obligation. And we really are now moving from a come and see to a go and get orientation. That's what Jesus said to do anyway. And if the attractive people won't show up, Jesus said go on the highways and the byways and find those least desirable, least attractive folks. I don't know what that really looks like, but in an unchurched culture, there is a whole lot of those folks that wouldn't normally. When I went in the ministry, you know, when Billy and Mary had a fight in their marriage, one of those two usually ended up in church asking for help. And in our culture today, that's not happening. And when Mary and Joe's son, Joe, is getting in trouble, people used to call the pastor. And that, at least in this town, that's not the norm yet. There's a lot of other places they call, and we're one of many choices. So I'm not afraid to use, even at Veritas, I use the word customer service all the time. We're in a market-driven, we're consumers of things. People are making consumer-based decisions, and you know, I don't think it compromises the gospel to adopt that terminology. The alternative is empty buildings. So find a better sword to fall on, not that one.
Okay. So I think we've been looking quite a bit at this external focused. So in terms of also the second portion of that goal, being internally strong, how does that play out? You mentioned a little bit in
sermons. That's a good question.
By putting some things into your sermons that would really strengthen those that are looking.
Well, we have a small group ministry. Small groups with trained leaders. Those groups reflect the personalities of those attending. The demographics are broad. Some of the small groups are all couples with young children. A couple of the groups are ages 20 to 80. Then we also do something called life training for the adult, which others might call it Sunday school. We call it Sunday school for the children, but it's life training for the adults. And right now we're emphasizing this double-pronged, the externally strong, internally strong, externally focused in our life training. We've been doing that, frankly, since January. But then we'll also do Sunday school from nursery up through 12th grade. And we've got teachers for all those age groups. And then during the worship time, congregational worship time, we also then have children's church through 3rd grade. After the worship, we have all the children worship with their parents, and then it's a very smooth transition. We take the offering and we dismiss the children, and their leaders are waiting for them. We have a group called C-Cubed, which is I'm also a KU religious affiliate, which so our C-Cubed group has the same acceptance. It's in the same category as Campus Crusade for Christ, InterVarsity, Navigators. So C-Cubed at University of Kansas has access to any room that we need, which is great. And C-Cubed, there's several things we do there. We have a luncheon, free luncheon for college students the first Sunday of every month. And it's really a demographic of 18 to 30 because there's all different kinds of college students, graduate assistants, part-time married students, all that. Some have children, some don't. We've got some key people that have led large campus-type ministries with us now, just recently came to the church, and we're thinking that our campus presence is really going to. At one time, this church was also the headquarters for Campus Crusade for Christ. Their offices were here, and that attracted lots of college students. Couldn't exactly tell you why they moved out. I know they were asked to move out. There may have been rivalries. I mean, I'm sure you've never heard that in your interviews, that church people fight. But those offices moved to Grace Evangelical Presbyterian Church. and are still there, I think. Though I'm friends with all those folks, and the Navigators do their praise and worship practice here on Wednesday night. They actually have their meetings on campus, but we host their rehearsals on Wednesdays. So the Internal Strong, we sponsor Troop 53, which is the largest Boy Scout troop in the city. Lots of scouts. A lot of the landscape projects around the building actually are done by Eagle Scouts. Some of the recent landscaping was done by Eagle Scouts. We have a prayer meeting, a group called PUSH on Wednesdays, Pray Until Something Happens. We have a men's fraternity we use, forgetting the man who founded men's fraternity, Ray Lewis, I believe that's his name. Ray Lewis founded men's fraternity, so that's a DVD series. One of our treasurer actually manages the Hamptons, so men who come get a free breakfast at the Hampton, and it starts at 6:30, and that's a great discipleship for men. We have semester women's groups that do a specific study that our women's leader does, and then we have a support group for women that live in chronic pain that's both outreach orientated and internally orientated. So we have some ladies that fibromyalgia, those kinds of difficult to define diseases that are just life controlling sometimes. And so those ladies meet as a support system, looking at both homeopathic cures, emotional cures, as well as medical solutions. And that has attracted women throughout the community who mm-hmm. struggle with the same thing. And the goal really isn't to convert them and bring them into our church, but again, to serve the community. We host MOPS, Mothers of Preschoolers, which is an independent organization, but we're the host of a new group that they were anticipating 5 or 6 this year, and they've been averaging 35 or so, and they meet here twice a week, and so we host them. Again, strengthening young families. But not everyone that comes to MOPS attends our church. In fact, I think only 2. In fact, we have more MOPS that attend the original one over at the Free Methodist Church that attend here than actually attend this one, because they were in the original group and haven't changed. And then a youth group called Loud House that we're now in the process of looking for a full-time person for that. And we have a group called FOG 456, which is on Wednesdays for 4th, 5th, and 6th graders. Mm-hmm. Followers of God, FOG.
cute.
Probably the parents that are more in the FOG than the kids. But,
yeah. Well, good. So then in terms of how each of these groups are led up, is it just people within the organization that feel called to it? Is there a specific leadership process or elders?
Unfortunately, right now, I'm heading up about all of that. But that's, that's why I'm probably drooling when I'm talking to you. But we have a rule of 2. So, my goal is to find 2 people to lead all of those. And I broke my arm, patting myself on the back. Actually, we do have that kind of leadership in all those groups. And frankly, they're very, very good at what they do. My job is to resource them, solve problems for them. I have a mantra, be accessible, offer solutions, build relationships, be accessible, and offer solutions. That's kind of my leadership mantra, and so I'm there for them. If they need training, I look for that, or we'll go to seminars. We recently went to a Sunday school teachers convention. We have several families. We have a 10-year-old with Down syndrome. We have other families with children with learning disabilities, and so we're looking at how to mainstream some of those children. Just it's hard for them to fit in. We have autistic families with autistic children. It's just such a challenge, and that's often overlooked in church ministry, to be totally honest. And so we think we've come up with a program to assimilate them into our Sunday school classes too. Autism in particular keeps a lot of families from attending church, or mom goes when dad stays home and vice versa. Mm-hmm. We've met numbers of families that do that. So the rule of 2, and a non-member can be a leader if they go through a background check, go through an interview process, just checking qualifications and experience, and then we have them look at the EFCA statement of faith and make sure they agree with it. But not transient community, but a mobile society like ours, people come and go. What we're striving with our campus ministry is not to have it be like a an old high, you know, like a youth group, a college youth group. You know, Willow Creek, the big church up in South Barrington, did a revisioning study, and they discovered their 18 to 30 year olds did not know how to go to grown up church. That's what Bill Hybels has concluded. They somehow we didn't train 18 to 30 year olds how to go to big boy church. We don't want that to happen. And they're revisioning, they're redoing everything at Willow Creek. And the current leaders we have, one young man who's now an employee of the University of Kansas led a campus church of 800 within a larger church in Norman, and he saw that. He just saw herding as opposed to shepherding. So we're really trying to reorientate that way. But the rule of two gives us two people to lead. That rule of two might be a couple, husband, wife, but it still would need to be another person outside the family. And that's very healthy. Iron sharpens iron, balances each other. And in a mobile society, if somebody leaves, you've got a leader. The ministry doesn't die until you get another person to come in. So it's worked well. And it's biblical. You know, Jesus sent people out two by two. So it's very biblical. It's been successful. And it's a reorientation because, frankly, every ministry here had one person. And when that one person left, then sheep without a shepherd stray. And it wasn't healthy for the church. And we just, you can't afford to waste 2 months while you're looking for a leader. So.
Okay, let's see. I was kind of bouncing around on the website a little bit last night, and I saw an advertisement for Tables for Eight.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about
Well, that's
that.
Another, because we are now adding folks. When I say, you know, adult attendance is over 200 now, there's probably 300 that are coming and going. So we've got the core that was here when I got here, about 150. And or 180, I mean, depends how you count. And we've got groups of 50 that exchange pews every week. And so we weren't yet being successful in assimilating them into existing small groups. And so the goal through the Circles of Eight or Dinners of Eight is over the course of a year or a semester that there would be three or four times when the people organizing that mix and match folks, and then they leave it to that group to get to know each other over a meal. And the goal would be that some small groups will be spawned from that. Mm-hmm. Not everyone in that is not already in a small group. Some of them signed up for Dinners of Eight in small groups. But I think we've got some members of small groups that probably ought to be leading by now. Some just love their small group. I mean, they've buried children through that group.
Yeah.
They've married children through that group. They've went through divorce within that group, and it would be silly for me to split those groups apart. It would just be dumb. I would really be dumb. So that's what the Dinners of Eight is. And one more way to try to assimilate. We don't want it to become a program. That's my nervousness, and right now it's being treated a little bit like a program. Mm-hmm. You've got to count it. We want to serve you. No one needs one more thing to do. So we're trying to be very intentional, make sure people understand why we're doing that. You know, I learned at Veritas when I would go to seminar and come up with a new idea, if I didn't pull something off the bottom that wasn't working, it was silly for me to bring in a new idea. In fact, we actually did a book by Andy Stanley. I just thought of this, The Seven Practices of Effective Ministry. And So some of the terminology that I've used, frankly, is adopted from that book. I wish I could say that all those are our thoughts. But I used it also at Veritas, and it worked very well there. And again, someday I'll think of something original and write a book about it. But so far, really good. And remember, it was good.
Well, sounds like you have your hands on anything.
Yeah,
about
yeah.
Well, good deal. Well, we're definitely closing in on an hour here, possibly over. I haven't been watching too quickly on the clock here. But are there any stories or any memories that you would want written down about your time here?
In Lawrence, Kansas? Goodness. Well, you know, some of mine aren't all that happy, frankly, though I'm thrilled to be here and see the growth. Yeah, I moved here in 2004, and if you were around here in those days, the board president of Veritas Christian School murdered his wife 2 weeks after I got here. Being a Christian school in a liberal-orientated community, we were attacked immediately. I mean, because right? Every Christian murders his wife. You know, I remember looking out my window and the arm of a newspaper reporter, you know, the TV camera would be looking through my window on Michigan, looking through my office, trying to get a picture of me.
Oh, my goodness.
Had reporters coming in pretending. I mean, and this guy knows who he is. He was an LJ World reporter. Came in posing as a policeman. I mean, he really did. And to try to, and the story, thank goodness, wasn't at Veritas. It had nothing to do with Veritas. But I think there were people subtly hoping that it would be. I do. And the following year, we had a young lady who died playing the choking game within our school. And that made national headlines. The family was on Oprah and talked about the choking game. And, you know, if you're familiar with that, you know. Yeah. And so those are not necessarily the happy memories, the exciting memories things like the Martin Luther King Day events that I've been a part of, seeing those things happen and seeing evangelicals meeting together, blacks and whites. I have good friends, Johnny Morse, who I've mentioned to you, working with First Nations folks at Haskell. We've had Johnny hear and speak. My son Micah was the worship leader for the Fellowship of Christian Athletes on the campus for a while. And, you know, those are all tremendous, tremendous victories to see that kind of working together. And to see, and so to go back to some of what I was saying about the Southern Baptist Evangelical Free Church, when I came, I said, you know, we probably just need to decide who we are. And so we did drop the Southern Baptist affiliation. And it was ironic in a world that doesn't, people don't tend to look for denominations. They do, frankly, look for the pastor that they want to listen to, or a ministry that they, you know, that their family needs. When we decided to not be Southern Baptist, there were a few folks that were here because we were Southern Baptist, and so they left. And to see us having to find ourselves and deciding to stay with that, it's brought confidence with those that have stayed. And so when people come, we know who we are, so we can tell them who we are. And that's been really, really helpful. The other thing is, having been a part of Veritas, I found a very vibrant Christian community in the city. Because we were a non-denominational school, 30 different churches were either sending their children or we had our teachers were coming to that school. That's you know, I don't think we had any more than eight students at that time from any one church in the city. And I think we had 165 students, which isn't a large school. So you can see it was very broad-based,
yeah,
which helped us survive when our board president did what he did and when the student, you know, did what happened to her. And that broad base really made it a bump, a speed bump, not a closed door. And I've seen a very vibrant Christian community. The LAE, the Lawrence Associate of Evangelicals, has been a very positive for me to be chosen, you know, to lead it these last couple of years. A victory for us, I'll be honest, for evangelicals was maybe offensive to some. While we have a domestic registry for, you know, same-sex couples, there was an effort to bring some short-sighted protections for transgender and cross-dressing, and we were able to stop that particular ordinance, which I thought is beneficial for the city in the areas of litigation. You know, a man dresses a woman who goes into a men's restroom, and I know not all of them are molesters, but to be honest, it would expose the city to a lot of potential litigation and would force us to put in a third bathroom. You know, you'd have your family bathroom, your male and female, and we just couldn't afford to do that. Not many businesses could. And Manhattan, Kansas, which would not have ever been considered Lawrence, just, you know, their Human Relations Commission just passed unanimously and is giving it to the City Commission, and I'm working closely with those guys over there to help them maybe see if they can't, in my mind, bring a voice of logic to it. I had a ministry in the past called Freedom's Call to Gay Men and Women. While I don't approve of that behavior, neither do I approve of gluttony. So, you know, I work closely with gays and lesbians, embrace them, but work to minister to them the love of Christ, just like I would someone who comes in and says, you know, I'm living on coffee and coca, you know, which I don't think is healthy either. So those are victories. Now, not everybody would describe that relation or the emission of victory. But to the evangelical mind, I think most would.